What is up, guys? It's Mark here, back again with another episode, or one, two, three, our ninth episode, damn, of the Sensory Corner. Thank you so much for tuning in, folks. As you already know, this podcast surrounds all conversations, sensory, parenting, and occupation related. My name is Mark. I'll be your host for today, and this podcast is being brought to you guys by Senso Minds. Senso Minds is dedicated to designing and developing new sensory kits, sensory toys, and sensory chew necklaces to help your child gain the sensory stimulation they need to integrate into the world around them. Anyways, I'm going to jump right into this podcast topic. Today, we will be talking about mental health. Yeah, you heard me right, folks. It's a very heavy and large topic, which is being openly held in today's day and age. And I'm super happy that, yes, we are being more open, we are being more transparent, and even honest about our experiences and struggles with respect to mental health. However, I will say, throughout these conversations, there's a very large population, segment of the population, which is being left out. And you might be asking, oh, who is that, Mark? I'm talking about children, folks. No one really talks about how exactly does mental health impact children and how does it manifest itself. So that's what today's podcast is dedicated towards. We will be talking about how exactly does mental health pop up and impact children, and in particular, children of whom are neurodiverse, whether they may have sensory issues or on the spectrum, whatever it may be, they're pushing through a world which was not designed for them. So to also deal with mental health struggles, whether that be anxiety or stress, it becomes a totally different ballgame. So to help us out with this conversation, we brought on an OT of whom is a very close friend of ours. You can find her on Instagram. Her name is Emily Deller, and her Instagram tag is EmilyMarie_OT. And she'll be giving us some insights as to what are the red flags you guys can keep an eye out for children of whom are neurodiverse and are also going through mental health struggles. And what can we as parents and caregivers also provide in terms of support to help them push through today's day and age? Anyways, that's enough for me. Let's just jump into this podcast topic. My name is Mark, and this is the Sensory Corner. Saying there are a bunch of little cues or flags which we can keep an eye out for, which could either indicate sensory issues or possibly mental health issues. But when you kind of mesh those two worlds together, what exactly do you look out for as an OT trying to assess a child's mental health?
So a lot of it comes from knowing the child's what we call their baseline. So what are they on? What are they like on a typical day? And from that, we want to see. I look for any changes in behavior. If there's behaviors that are out of the norm for that child, or if there's behaviors I've seen in the past that have kind of gone away and are resurfacing.
Oh, wow.
So that's from the behavioral aspect. From a sensory aspect, what I look at is, does the child show increased arousal or the extreme opposite, that decreased arousal? So when you think of increased arousal, you think of the fidgeting, nail biting, moving around all the time, increased appetite, wanting to be that like hyperactive that you think of. You can think of that as that increased arousal. Mm-hmm. Whereas the decreased arousal is really more of that fatigue, the lack of attention towards tasks, or the lack of motivation towards tasks, or seeming to be lack of motivation towards tasks. Decrease in appetite, not doing the typical activities that they do every day, or not showing those mannerisms that they show or would typically show.
Interesting. That distinction between sensory and just pure mental health, those two areas overlap so much because those are issues which I hear with respect to just sensory processing issues within children. You know, they have a sensory aversion to food. They don't like to eat food, but maybe that decrease in appetite or the inability to feed themselves, the act of feeding, may stem from the fact that they might just be anxious and stressed out because stress decreases appetite. Is there any way for you to continue to keep digging in and really understand the child and meet them where they're at? Like, I know we're kind of beating down a dead horse here. I just really want to understand, like, what do you do as an OT to really be sound in your decision to say that this is a mental health issue or this is an anxiety issue versus this is just purely a sensory issue?
Necessarily ever be able to define if it is one or the other. And if it is a mental health issue where sensory is not a concern at all, say that you are anxious, there's a big test coming up and you're really anxious or the child's really anxious on taking that test, but those might start to pop up because their body is not able to emotionally regulate. So one of the things that I like to bring up and how I kind of see it going on in my life is if I'm driving to a new place that I've never been to before, and I'm super reliant on my GPS, putting it anywhere around it. And I grew up with like Ask Jeeves and Google Maps. So that's even worse.
Yeah. MapQuest.
But if, yes, MapQuest. Wrong, by the way. So when I'm driving somewhere new and I'm super reliant on my GPS, typically I'm listening to Audible or a podcast or music in the background. I actually have to turn that music off because my brain can't process being able to follow the exact directions while that music is playing in the background. So my own anxiety, even though I don't typically have sensory processing differences, because I am so anxious, it's causing me to not be able to process or filter out those sounds that are there.
Interesting. And, oh, wow, I didn't even think about that, but that makes so much sense in the aspect that certain processes can override other ones, or there just might be way too much input from a certain area or aspect of your mental health or your overall life where you can't, you know, you can't organize or you can't interpret any other data, quote unquote, or input coming in from your external environment. Is that the same thing which happens with children then, or is there a different process which occurs within, you know, a child of whom is between 0 to 5?
It's typically within the tolerance level in terms of it'll portray in different ways, but it's the same kind of like neurology behind it. Mm-hmm. So for a child, you might see a longer meltdown. You might see that something that doesn't bother them usually is all of a sudden starting to bother them. That's also an indicator that there might be some anxiety or there are some underlying feelings that aren't felt. The other thing that we have to keep in mind is that a lot of our children with special needs have a difficulty with that eighth sense, which is that interoception, and that's understanding the feelings inside the body. So when they start to feel anxious, they don't know what that feels like in their body. They could interpret that like, you know how kind of anxiety feels like the tingling in some part of your body. Yeah. They don't know that that necessarily means anxiety. They could think, oh, well, that means my body needs to run right now. It needs to move. So you can't necessarily, going back to that point, divide between mental health and the sensory. They're super connected in the body. So it's really treating them together.
Definitely.
What that child needs. Yeah.
Yeah. No, when you break it down in that sense, it makes a lot more makes a lot more sense to me, just because sometimes I forget to do that interoception as well, you know, especially being under quarantine. I forget to drink water and it'll be 8 a.m., like 8 p.m. at night. And I'm like, what? Like, why does it smell like coffee on my desk? It's just 8 different coffee cups. I was like, oh,
oh God.
Never doing that again, by the way, folks. You don't sleep from that. But, you know, like at the end of that night, I was like, why is my heartbeat being so fast? Why does it feel like it's going to beat outside of my chest? Like, why do I feel all tense? And I realized, oh, it's just because I didn't drink water. So interoception is hard for adults, you know, even for me, and I'm always self-reflecting, especially nowadays. So to expect that from a child, it's even more so difficult. So it really does place, I guess, an explanation as to why they might melt down, or they might, you know, have behavioral issues, or might have a temper tantrum. I just wanted to know, though, what are the impacts of anxiety on a child, though? We always talk about mental health with respect to adults and how that can have consequences in our own daily lives. But sometimes we don't really talk about what the overall occupation or daily life of a child looks like and how anxiety can truly impact them, and more so not only in the short term, but also in the long term in their development.
Yeah. Right. So the way that anxiety can really impact a child is that it's disrupting their occupational performance. So it's disrupting their typical routines they're able to do, their typical mentality, or as they're busy thinking about something else or trying to deal with something else in their body. So it's then splitting their time between what they're usually supposed to do or typically supposed to do during a day to having to deal with something else on top of that, which us as adults have an easier time of doing. We're used to juggling different hats and things like that, to go to school, to learn, to play, to follow the parents' rules, and that's it. So they don't necessarily have to worry about all of the minutiae in the background that are going on. So when you do have something like anxiety, you can see difficulties with learning, you can see those new behaviors, and you can see lasting behaviors if they're not dealt with or they don't learn how to properly manage them. Some withdrawal, and you can see that in social situations, in respect to family relationships with peers. When you look at going into like the teenagers and anxiety really showing up in a diminished self-worth and self-esteem, which is definitely not something that we want. The sooner that we can treat it with a plethora of different strategies, it's better. The better they have really getting on back on track to where they are and learning and growing and progressing.
Definitely. And this kind of popped up in my head, and I don't think this is brought up enough in conversations. In a sense, a lot of the sensory strategies which you guys implement with children, they're little manifestations of coping mechanisms. You know, sometimes I'll play with my shirt collar, or I'll stroke my chin just as a means of gaining sensory input. But oftentimes that will stem from just me trying to self-soothe and self-regulate myself. And it really goes to show that if a child is doing a certain behavior, it's their form of communication. It's their form of trying to let you know that something's up, but they might not be verbally expressing it. Or they might not be expressing it to themselves. They just know instinctually something is wrong with them.
Everyone has the initial intent to want to do good and to want to learn, to progress. That is just innate in every single person. So when you put something on them where that might not be really like capable for them at that time because they are dealing with something else, that's where then you do see the behaviors. And behavior 100% is communication, and behaviors really does give us an indication of, well, this isn't their normal, or this isn't their typical, so let's go back to kind of the building blocks, start there, and then move forward.
I want to be able to provide children, whether or not they're atypical or neurotypical, with some type of schedule, especially nowadays when we're under quarantine, so that there's some structure in their day and they know what to expect. If you're a parent out there going through mental health struggles, anxiety, which is totally fine, like that, I just want to like validate that for all of the listeners on this podcast. You understand how not only demoralizing it is, but how tasking it is, just because it's not something you're necessarily expecting. And if you're expecting it, then it actually acts as a feedback loop to your own anxiety, which doesn't help anybody. So it's like a lose-lose situation here if you think about it. Like for a child, even though there aren't that many occupations, the child's main occupation is to play, is to explore. They're not adept to being able to deal with these new stressors and these new variables, which are throwing them for a whole new other curve.
They don't know why. Yeah.
Exactly. And sometimes I don't even know why whenever I get like an anxiety or panic attack. And it's frustrating just because I'll need to lay down and I'll be like, why am I feeling this way? Why can't I move? Why can't I do anything today? And it's just more so that acceptance. But for a child, that can be so disorienting, that can be so jarring for them, to the point where all they know is that fight or flight response, you know. What I guess the question begs is, what can parents do then to help their child? You know, how can they better understand their child, but more so how can they support them throughout these mental health struggles, which are very apparent, especially nowadays when we're having these open discussions and it is being, you know, being pushed to the limelight almost.
Right. Well, I think first and foremost, parents have to take care of themselves before you can take care of someone else. And I know that that is said over and over, and it is completely hard to do because your child in you first and you want to be able to help them. But if anything is going to be triggering to you, or if it's going to put more stress in your place to where it might put you in a worse off place to not then be able to help your child, you want to avoid. So definitely taking care of your own mental health first. And being calm and ready to then enter into your child's world definitely helps set up for success. So I don't necessarily think that strategies in order to improve a child's mental health or deal with anxiety have to be the overhaul in a schedule or throwing in a bunch of different activities, like carving out 30 minutes here, 30 minutes there. It should flow naturally. It should be easy. Know that everyone has a lot on their plate right now. When I think of the things that a parent can do to really help their child, there's three different areas. Really focusing on those like habits and routines, looking at different sensory-based strategies that can be used in the home. So when you think of relationship skills, you're not only thinking of your relationship with their child, with your child, but the child's ability to have relationships with others. So it's definitely hard with children with disabilities and who are not neurotypical or atypical, because all of our children show different qualities of relationships in different ways. So knowing how your child shows their love and their caring and their how they're comfortable is definitely important. One of the things that is very empowering is always to stay positive with your child. So always focusing on the positive, using those positive words, whether or not you necessarily feel it at that time with your difficulties, you always want to show the positive, but also that there's good out in the world and there's things that are coming of it. I mean, especially with COVID-19 right now, it can be looked at as a very scary situation, but let's focus on the fact that we get to stay home with our siblings, or that they are now learning something new with virtual learning, things like that. So a positive, and really getting that child to feel the positive in their head and kind of switch their brain from towards the worry to going towards the hopeful is important.
It also occurred in my mind the fact that, you know, because children, especially from an early age or a younger age, they don't have as many occupations. You know, they're not expected to do as much. It doesn't mean that they're learning any less. It's more so they just need to put in a bit more effort and time into certain occupations so that they can slowly build up that independence, because a lot of skills overlap. And the reason why I bring this up is because anxiety can throw a big wrench into that. I think you kind of mentioned that. I don't know if the focused in on your mental health or your anxiety, it's very hard to focus on the occupation which you're trying to develop. So it really goes to show that trying to look after that within your child will in fact have a lot of developmental benefits in the long run.
And I mean, it's really important to know too that this isn't something that will come innate to a child who is experienced. They might not know that they need help or help when it's offered or changes when they're offered. But knowing that there needs to be something that does need to change in order for a child to come out of that anxiety or cope with that anxiety or deal with it is, does kind of lay on the parents. And it's up to them to start making those changes. It's definitely a lot to handle, but I think there are different small ways that it can be done. I mean, when you look at the relationship part of it, I mean, you can, like, maybe you are working on the computer and they have their own computer going, but at least you're in the environment where they can look to you and see that support. The other thing that, I mean, I even find beneficial for adults is really staying connected. So staying connected with family. About their child now doesn't see their friends every day or their classmates every day, or we miss holidays when you typically see others, like extended family. So having those phone calls, sending those letters, that snail mail, people love to get that too. having those Zoom sessions, like, that's all important to build those relationships and to maintain those relationships so that a child doesn't feel like they are going away.
Do you need to communicate and explicitly explain what mental health is and anxiety is to a child? Because I feel like, especially in my own life, it was only verbalized to me when I was around like 18. So I didn't really talk about mental health. I never heard the words anxiety and stress being placed into the context of my own well-being. It was just something I kind of heard being thrown around. Is it too young to be having those conversations with your child, or are you just trying to build up those coping mechanisms, that occupation of trying to build up interoception within the child?
Yeah, so it's not necessarily denying those topics, it's just changing the words around them and the way that you explain them. So when you think of where your child is at, you have to think about the language that they have and that they expressively and receptively understand. So stress and anxiety are super abstract term.
Yeah.
Very hard to understand. Yeah. And when you ask someone, what is anxiety, they typically give you an example of what it is, of how they experience. What's really hard for a child to do is take those terms and then generalize it to their own lives. So the way that we want to portray mental health and give and expose that to children is by putting it in those simple terms of, this is how it feels in my body. And let's bring it back to the feeling. Do I see it in my fingers? Do I feel it in my toes? Is it a prickling? Is it an itch? Is it that hunger? Like, what exactly is it? Hunger is kind of abstract too. Like, what is it exactly in your body? And how are you feeling it? Like, is my heart beating a lot faster now? that's how we want to expose them, and getting them to notice those little changes.
Wow.
And that can be very difficult for children, especially with difficulties with verbal abilities and communication.
Yeah. I was about to say that, you know, it's easier said than done. And if a child has a cognitive delay or they have a speech delay and they can't even express to you or communicate, if you're trying to have that conversation with them, then that's no fault of their own. That road is just, it's difficult even for me to be able to understand my own anxiety. I keep relating it back to myself just because I'm trying to put myself into the shoes of a kid. That conversation took years. You know, it took years of trying to figure out, like, why do I feel this way? Why, you know?
Right.
Yeah.
So it's when they're at that point where they aren't able to make those connections of body's feeling right, or they don't have the communication in order to express it, mm-hmm. that's where it really does come onto those outside caregivers to be able to say, this is what you need right now, or let's try this. It needs to be a co-occupation with the parents, so that mm-hmm. need to work together in order to move forward.
Okay.
So they know they can't necessarily do it alone.
Mm-hmm. And man, I'm learning so much from this conversation. These are things which they seem intuitive, but we forget to do these things on a day-to-day basis, not only with our children, but more so for our own selves. You know what I mean? This leads nicely into the next question I wanted to ask. Like, what are some resources and strategies which parents can look into in order to be able to, you know, successfully enact that co-occupation with you and with the child?
So some of the resources if you want to look at, first and foremost, definitely seek professional help if you need it. If you're unable to provide those strategies, if you think that you need more insight into how your specific child or individual child is portraying anxiety or showing their anxiety, definitely seek professional help, whether that's the occupational therapist, a teacher that you have contact with, a psychologist, a mental health psychologist, psychiatrist, school counselor, really anyone on your child's team will be able to point you towards who to talk to in order to learn more about your child and help them with that anxiety. There's the National Institute of Mental Illness really has a lot out there as to how to ease a child. They have resources about COVID-19 and how that's impacting and things you can do with your children. The Mayo Clinic also has some things about how to talk to your child. But then definitely utilizing social stories. Something that occupational therapists, psychologists, BCBAs, every speech therapist can give you access to, and there's actually some free ones out there I gave you to be able to talk with your child about things that they might not be noticing, or even just the bringing up what mental health is and what anxiety might feel like and portray in their own lives. You can write a social story about that to see if they can relate to that at all.
Mm-hmm. I know me and you know what a social story is. I only learned about it like 2 months ago after talking to you guys. But for all the listeners on the podcast who might not know what that is, what exactly is a social story?
Sure. So a social story is really just a few pages, a short book or story on about a certain issue. So it looks at an issue in a positive means. It brings it into simple terms, and it also adds lots of visuals specific to that child's interests and where they are. For that child to be able to relate to it.
Interesting. Yeah. And they're crafted in such a way where I think it's like in third person so that the child can take on the role of somebody as opposed to being like, this is how you feel. It's more so like, correct, this is how somebody else feels.
There's a whole science behind it. The amount of pictures and words you're supposed to have on a page. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, definitely. Hopefully, you know, I'll do some digging after this podcast and hopefully I can link some down in the description. So that you parents can understand, you know, can share some social stories with your own children, especially with respect to mental health. I'll see if I can do some digging on that. I kind of cut you off there. Are there any other resources which a parent could possibly look into or anything which they should keep in mind with respect to their child's anxiety and mental health?
I would definitely keep in mind that there are sensory-based strategies out there that can work. Yeah. Sensory strategies aren't perfect. It's not try once and it's definitely not going to work kind of thing. So keep that in mind when trying new things with a child. But using deep breathing exercises and games, really that heavy work and that proprioception, so giving off effort, using your body and your joints, are all ways in order to help a child emotionally regulate.
Interesting. And, you know, it's really cool after talking to OTs such as yourself, individuals who focus so much on sensory processes and different activities to stimulate those different aspects. By doing those activities, inherently you're giving the child different avenues which make them feel good, you know. And that in itself is like a coping mechanism. Even though you're not trying to develop a coping mechanism, you're just trying to get them towards a certain occupation. But it develops that agency in the child even like so much more, which is, I find super fascinating.
I mean, a lot of OT is really that incidental learning. It's that child's having fun. They might not know that they're learning coping strategies for when they're anxious, but they're learning those skills to be able to use when that does happen.
Definitely. Everything you do is intentional. Like, it might seem like you guys are just playing with the child, but no, you're building so many different skills. And I hope that's something parents out there, especially after quarantine, can understand once the clinics do open up. I think everybody's starting to gain a better understanding and a better appreciation for what you guys do. Because I know you're joking in the beginning, but you guys literally are magicians.
Yeah. There's a lot on our plates, but there's a lot on everyone's plates in this situation. So.
No, definitely.
We're there to sort through them.
Yeah. Anyways, thank you so much for joining us on today's podcast. I feel like this was a very candid but much needed conversation to have for the community, not only for the children, but more so for the parents to keep themselves not in check, but to constantly have that self-reflection and understand where you guys are at, you know? So thank you so much. Yeah, this is super helpful. Awesome. So before we tune out, I just want to do a little shameless plug. So can people find you on Instagram, Emily?
Sure. So I am on Instagram at EmilyMarie_OT.
EmilyMarie_OT. So yeah. All the details will be placed in the description. You post tons of content, like a lot of sensory activities, which are super applicable at home. And, you know, they all have their own benefits. And you post fairly frequently, eh?
Beginning of quarantine, but it's going kind of long. So yeah. It's a few times a week, a different video.
Yeah, definitely. But yeah, for all the parents of whom might be running out of ideas, Emily is a definitely great resource for those activities if you need to spark your own imagination. And I don't know if like I can't speak on your behalf, but if parents have any questions with respect to activities, are they free to shoot them over via Instagram DMs or I don't know?
Yeah, definitely via Instagram DMs. I get back to fairly quickly. I'm also part of the Sensor Mind Parent Facebook group. So if you have any questions there, I will also answer them there.
Awesome. Cool. Well, thank you so much, Emily. It was a pleasure talking to you. Anyways, this is the Sensory Corner. My name is Mark, and that's all for today, folks. Goodbye.
You've just been tuned into the Sensory Corner, a podcast surrounding all conversations sensory, parenting, and occupation related. My name is Mark. I was your host for today, and this podcast is being brought to you guys by Senso Minds. Senso Minds is dedicated to designing and developing new, fun, and engaging sensory-stimulating toys for your child to be able to gain the sensory stimulation they need to best integrate into the world around them. If you're curious and want to learn more, want to buy one of our sensory kits, sensory chew necklaces, or even our weighted blankets, be sure to search us up or go to our website via www.sensominds.com. Or give us a follow on our social media handles via Facebook, Instagram, or Pinterest by simply typing in Senso Minds. That's SENSOMINDS. If you liked what you hear and you like the information on this podcast, be sure to give us a little subscribe by hitting that subscribe button on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts. And also, leave us a 5-star review. It really does help us increase our reach and helps us connect with more SLPs, more OTs, and more sensory parents of whom will benefit from the information of which is being dished out on these podcasts when we bring on these specialists to talk to. Anyways, that's all for me. My name is Mark, signing out. This is the Sensory Corner.